Welcome to History Edge, for students by teachers. This is a History Teachers Association of Victoria podcast, part of the Victorian Challenge and Enrichment series of activities and programs that are being funded by the Victorian Department of Education. I'd like to start today by welcoming all the VCE students out there who are tuning in. We hope you enjoy this podcast. There are lots of factors that contribute to student success, and we know that one of the most powerful factors is the classroom teacher. I should note that our interviewees would never claim to be the only reason why their students do so well. But here at the HTAV, we suspect that they know a thing or two about how to enjoy and succeed in VCE history, not just in exams, but across the whole year. They're here to share with you the guidance and advice that they give to their students about how to do really well in VCE history. We hope you find it helpful. For this, our first episode, I'm joined by Victorian VCE history teacher, Isabella Webster. Welcome, Isabella.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Thank you so much for being a part of our series. We know it's a very busy time, so we really value your input.
It's a pleasure.
Can you tell our lovely listeners a little bit about yourself?
I teach history at Loreto and Toorak, and I've been teaching history now for probably more years than I'd care to count. I've always taught VCE, which I really love. Myself, I studied history when I was at school and then at university, and I was very fortunate to be able to study university in Italy, in Florence. So I loved that experience.
Oh, that would have been lovely.
It was wonderful, and it really has made me an advocate of learning in the culture that you're studying. It has a depth to it that
sort of doing the history, not just reading about it.
Yeah, absolutely. At university, I also had opportunities to study a lot of Australian history and medieval history and ancient history. And being involved in some publication and writing, which I really enjoyed.
Oh, fantastic.
So I really loved those years of being at university, and it's one area that I'm a little bit envious of our students, that they get to have that experience again. And, I love my teaching, really.
Always good to hear. If you love what you do, you know what they say, you never work a day in your life.
That's right. The marking, maybe not so much, but the teaching is wonderful.
Oh, that's always the marking, isn't it? So what history have you been teaching in VCE recently?
Recently I've been teaching ancient history, and at my school we focus on Egypt and Rome.
Oh, lovely. I think for me, I mean, I'm like you, Isabella. I did have a chance to study in Italy as well as part of my uni experience, and, yeah, I love it. It's fantastic. So today we're going to explore some strategies that could help all VCE history students, but given that you teach ancient history, or you have been teaching ancient history, there might be some ancient-specific tips and tricks in there, but we'd like to reassure all our listeners that there'll be something for everyone. I think there's always something you can apply, a study technique or an approach to your studies that crosses the boundaries of the different pathways that we see in VCE.
Absolutely. I was going to say that I usually start with my students by talking about why they've chosen history, and in my case, ancient history. And overwhelmingly, students choose history because they enjoy it, because there's something about their study that's of interest to them and which they want to explore. Sometimes they've got a personal connection. They might have a cultural connection to the societies that they're studying, and sometimes they're just interested in the content that we're looking at. And I really like to know what it is about the study that they're interested in, because overwhelmingly that will be a hook for them. And we know that when we feel positively towards a subject or any activity in our life, we're much more likely to be motivated to do the work of that subject.
And so, absolutely. That reminds me of something that we were chatting about off air recently, finding a love of the stories and enjoying them. Can you tell our listeners a bit more about that and why it's so important?
I think it's really important for two reasons. One, when you've really engaged and you've It's captured your imagination. You're much, that creates a whole emotional and even hormonal response in you, and you feel those positive, happy feelings, and you engaged in your learning, and it gives a depth to your learning that maybe you don't have when you're looking at it merely from a set of tasks. I also think it's really important as people to be aware of the different perspectives, the different experiences in history, and to be looking for those experiences, those different stories that capture our imagination and give us a better sense of what that time period was like. So my first piece of advice really to my students when they're asking about their studies is to make sure that they're doing the things that's really going to foster this love for their subject. And I would suggest doing that in a broad range of ways that suits you. So there's some brilliant podcasts that you can listen to and that you can use in your downtime or your exercise time. There are great films that are set in these contexts. I love reading historical narratives, which is basically a fiction that's set in a historically accurate period. So the story might be fiction, but the period is accurate. A lot of major institutions, given the restrictions with COVID, have adapted really significantly and put a lot of their exhibitions online. So there's some really wonderful exhibitions you can do. You can even just give yourself permission to do a bit of your own investigating. And I say to my students that this should be a fun time. This is like your pajama time if you're at home, where you're going to, Friday night movies with popcorn and relaxing, or you're going to get dressed and go for comfortably and go for a nice walk in the sun and listen to a podcast that interests you. Do it with other people if it's appropriate, or by yourself. Don't feel that investigation needs to be directly linked to all of the dot points in the study design. You know, if you're looking at Egypt and you want to investigate Old Kingdom Egypt, go for it. It will help you because, first of all, it's going to help you to be interested and engaged. It'll also give you a context. It'll expose you to the language, the terminology. And
such valuable things there.
Really important, and something that the more familiar you are with the terminology, the easier it is to learn the content. It's also sometimes a little bit nebulous to get your head around the values and the culture of a completely different civilization. So if you've had an experience that immerses you in it, even just temporarily, you get more of a sense of why certain things are important to them or why they might have prioritized one part of society over another. So it will help you in a way that you can't quite put your finger on.
Quantify, but it's definitely there.
Yeah, exactly. And of course,
I think that's such an important message for VCU students to hear, because there's a constant focus on the tunnel vision, the end goal, the exam at the end of the year. And you've got to remember to enjoy the journey on the way there. And I have to admit, I have actually read recently myself that when you engage in the stories, there's more of your brain that's actually engaging in the content that you're trying to take in. And therefore, you're better able to recall it and you're better able to analyze, say, the significance of elements of that content. So I think this is such an important message, and I'm so glad that you're here to pass it on.
Thank you. I think there are a couple of things that are going on there. One is when your emotional state is more positive, so when you're calmer and happier, you're much more receptive to learning. Also, when you are learning stories rather than just fragmented facts, it gives you an overarching context to put the different pieces of information into, and that helps you to connect it. But I think when you're thinking about the process, when you're thinking about the exam, it's also important, can be a bit scary. Some of my students find this a bit scary, We can find that our anxiety arises, but set a goal. Set yourself a goal for what you want to do. What is it you want to achieve in this particular subject area? And now it may be quite precise. It might be attached to a study score. It might be attached to a particular exam result, but it may not. It might be about being able to say that you've done your best. It might be about developing your essay writing skills. It might be about developing your thinking skills. So I think it's really worthwhile for students who might be listening to this to give themselves a moment to stop and think, what is it that I'd really like to achieve from my study of history? And then be brave and write it down somewhere for yourself.
I like that. And it could even be, I suppose, broadening your cultural horizons or broadening your understanding of how the world around us is working and really looking even further beyond the history studies to how this is going to help you in later life, because history is so valuable for that.
I have students who often want to be able to engage with their relatives, or they want to understand their own culture, and that is a very worthwhile goal. And I would definitely, once you've written your goal, I would think about for yourself, how does that fit into your bigger picture of what it is that you want to achieve for yourself? So that goal that relates to history, how is it going to fit into your bigger plan for yourself? And that's important to connect to, because it gives you the why of all the doing that you are going to be focused on for the next little while. And again, with the big picture, you know, some students are very clear about wanting to get a certain HR, or they want to get a certain course, but it may be that they want to be able to say at the end of the year, I had a good year, I really enjoyed myself, I learned a lot, I applied myself, I learned how to study. It's just about, for yourself, taking a moment and thinking, what is important in this process for me, and how does it fit into my broader goals for myself and how I see my life?
Yeah, I think that's great. It's so important to be able to do that and not get stuck in that sort of, like, the door comes down at the end of the year. This is about so much more than that, and it's a great way to look at it. So thank you for that. That's great. Keeping on with the theme of enjoying the narrative, I believe that you encourage your students to find the less public narrative. Is that something you can tell us a bit about?
Yes, absolutely. So this particularly relates to how they look at the information that we're learning and how they make choices about collecting their notes or their evidence. When we look at these pieces of evidence, often they're produced by people from the upper classes, but there are hints in there of other people's experiences. So they might be looking, for example, we've just recently looked at the Second Punic War, and there's a whole lot of legislation that came from the Roman Senate during that period, which was about regulating behaviour in the city and regulating, you know, whether or not people could mass in certain locations, whether or not they were allowed to talk about public matters in open spaces. There was regulation about clothing, so that's called a sumptuary law, how much could be spent on clothing. So all of this information is usually looked at in terms of how did Rome recover from a particular loss in a battle, or the Battle of Cannae, and the power of the Senate, their ability to be organised and cohesive and to help Rome to recover her military position. But we can also look at this legislation from the perspective of the population, and that is, like us now, their daily activities are being curtailed in order to fit a larger agenda. One of the things that was prohibited was that women were not allowed to mourn in public.
And oh, wow.
Yeah. And the first question that I ask is, why would that be? And you'd have to say the answer is, twofold. From the women's perspective, they have lost their husbands and their sons and their male relatives, and so they would have, understandably, this massive feeling of grief, and they were, people were also prohibited from discussing public affairs because there was a fear that Hannibal with his army would invade Rome. So these, it appears from the information that remains, because not everything survives, that there was some acceptance of these, this legislation, and we haven't found up till now any sources which contradict and seem to protest that the women did protest the sumptuary laws, the laws governing how much they could spend on their clothing, some 16 years later, and Cato was very disparaging. He was a senator, and he was very disparaging of these women, and how dare they approach their senators. So when you're looking at this information, you can obviously use that to talk about the Battle of Cannae, how important it was, and the recovery of Rome and the Roman military. But we can also think about the experience of women and how it was regulated and how it changed over time. And as I teach girls, just thinking about the history from different perspectives, I think
it's really bringing in those historical perspectives, isn't it? It's looking at a broader, not just the immediate society that is perhaps more commonly reported on or recorded. It's really broadening your horizons, getting into the minds of different demographics. And I suppose you could almost say encouraging that historical imagination within clearer factual boundaries. When you have more information, you can, I suppose, better picture in your own mind what it looked like, what it felt like, what it, I don't know, smelt and tasted like. But because you've got more information, you're going to be more accurate because you can set those parameters in place.
Yes, absolutely. It helps to bring it to life, and then you can, as a student, start to ask better questions.
And that's so an important part of your VCE studies, is that inquiry process and those inquiry questions.
Yeah, I think it's really important, and we often focus on the chronology of events, and that's essential. If we muddle up our chronology, we confuse ourselves. But we also need to ask those other questions about significance and cause and effect, and whose experience is reflected in the information. And around this time of year, students become quite focused on collecting their notes and in preparation for the exam. And when my students are collecting those notes, I personally don't advocate that they write down everything that happened by hand.
Okay.
I know that there is a little bit of research that says that when you handwrite something, it does help you to remember. But I would save that for information that you reasonably expect you're going to have to use in the exam, not the vast sum of everything that's happened. I'd be asking myself, why is this significant? Is there a relationship between cause and effect? So what caused this, or did it create an effect? Whose experience is this information speaking to? So for all of the civilizations in ancient, our first area of study is looking at what it's like to live in a particular society. So one of the questions we have to keep asking ourselves is, of all the different groups in a society, whose experiences being represented in this information, or can we find them maybe in the gaps?
So I suppose branching out and finding those stories to fill those gaps is going to help you answer those historical thinking questions.
Yes.
So students are going out and looking for some of those podcasts or movies that you mentioned earlier. They can perhaps maybe even have the study design in front of them, or just those key questions in front of them, and just try and remember that as they enjoy the story or the podcast or whatever it is they choose to look at, and rather than feel pressure to take notes and write it down, they can think about, okay, what's the causational factor here, and what's the outcome of that? Which event that I'm seeing in this timeline is more significant than the other, or are they equally significant? Did one contribute to the other? That kind of thing?
Yeah, I would. I almost think of them as slightly separate activities. So for me, the mm-hmm. kind of enriching activities, you might happen upon information that's really relevant for your study notes. Mm-hmm. But I feel very comfortable that it's okay to do those things without them having a direct link to your study notes. When you're thinking about your study notes and you're thinking particularly about what makes good evidence, I'd have a separate list of criteria.
Okay.
So it needs to be relevant to the dot points. It needs to be quite precise information. So it might be factual information. It needs to relate to those dot points that we spoke about earlier, and those dot points are, you know, significance, causation, and looking at different experiences. And when we're looking for quotes, it's important to make a distinction between information which appears in historical sources, which is readily accepted factual information but makes for a fairly banal quote, and when we can hear a point of view being expressed.
Okay, so you're looking for the more lively quote?
Absolutely, and also one that is expressing a point of view about the historical period that you're looking at, the event or the person.
I feel like that would be really helpful when you are perhaps writing an essay and you've got your contention, and then you can either bring that quote in and it's going to either support your contention or even disagree with your contention. But geez, I think that would give you a fair bit to write about.
Absolutely, and that's another question I'd be asking when you're collecting your evidence. How am I going to use this? Mm. And if your answer is, I have no idea, then you need to be thinking before you spend however long copying it all out. And so you should have a little bit of a roadmap of what the dot points break down into in terms of their subpoints. And you should be able to think, well, this is going to tell me about this particular dot point, whether it's slaves or foreigners or women in the society you're looking at. And we don't want to take out and quote information which is available everywhere. That doesn't make a good quote. You can say that for yourself. If you want to give a start date to an event, or you don't need to quote that. You can make that as a statement. In your quotes, which take a lot of time to remember, should be a little bit lively. They should give a perspective of the author. I suggest to my students that they're not too long, because you have to remember them. So not three or four sentences. I also would suggest that they're not so short that they're meaningless, so not one or two words. And if it's possible, consider using them for more than one of your subtopics.
Oh, that's an interesting one.
So if you're going to, we're doing Rome, so Rome's a little bit on my mind. If you're looking at the trial of the Vestal Virgins and the fact that they, even though they were acquitted by the Pontiff Maximus, the people demanded that they were executed because the flame had gone out and Rome had lost the battle, you can use that to talk about women and the position of women, but you can also use that to talk about religion.
Okay. So what I'm sort of getting from this part of our chat is that the quotes, try and find something that's a little bit more colourful or a bit lively, that's offering a perspective that you can either use to perhaps support or disagree with a contention. But either way, when it's got a clear perspective, it's going to give you something I suspect would make it much easier to write about. Not too long, so no more than not three or four sentences, but then again, not too short. It's got to have some meaning and have some value in your writing. But also that flexibility, being able to use it for more than one element of your studies.
I think it's about being strategic. It won't work for every quote, but as far as possible, when you can, do that. Absolutely.
I think that kind of connects with what you were talking about with your notes. Don't spend heaps and heaps of time on notes that aren't going to be valuable. Economize your time, value your time, and use it productively. And this sounds like a really productive way to organize your notes and get some content behind you.
That's the intention. Absolutely. Absolutely. When you're using your quotes, you need to think about how it's going. You could use it to build your argument. And so, as you alluded to earlier, you might compare two perspectives on a particular topic. You may choose to disagree with a perspective. That's fine. But it's important not to just put the quote in and expect the quote to do the work for you. One trap that students fall into is feeling like they need to salt and pepper their paragraphs with as many quotes as possible, and having put them in, that their argument will be rock solid, if I could phrase it like that. You, as the writer, as the author, you're building your own argument. And so you need to always introduce your quote, and then you need to, teachers will say, you need to analyse your quote. Now, what do they mean when they put that word on your paper?
Just about what I was about to ask.
What they mean is, you've presented this to your reader. What do you want them to draw from this quote? How does this speak to the study of whatever topic you're making? How do you want them to understand the significance of the quote? If you have no idea, don't use it.
And I think that there's the good checkpoints that students should be using when they're picking out which quotes they're going to try and memorize or focus on. Definitely. And absolutely remembering that it's not just the quote that's going to do the work for you, that you've got to support that and tease it out and expand upon it.
And it needs to fit into the argument that you're building. And so one factor that maybe students may not be aware of, but it's possible for a teacher, an assessor, to read two pieces of writing. One might have a great number of quotes in it, but because the student's not arguing through the quotes, it's not as strong as another piece of writing, which maybe has fewer quotes numerically, but they're being used to greater effect. They're part of an argument that's being constructed.
Can I ask, what does it look like when a student argues through the quotes?
Well, first of all, I think the student has something to say, which sounds so obvious, but when you're writing and you're asked a question, you need to come up with an answer. You personally, as the student, you need to come up with an answer to that question. And there are a few potential traps that students fall into. One is telling the assessor everything they know about that general topic area and just doing a little bit of a shotgun blast and spraying unrelated.
Falling into that narrative trap.
The other is retelling the events.
So more of a chronology.
Yes. So what I would say, the first thing I'd say about that is, the thinking behind that is a bit of work, and it can make you a little bit uncomfortable, and you can have a few minutes of thinking, I don't know.
Very valid.
I don't know what my answer is. Well, don't stop there. Sit with that uncomfortableness. Persist. Don't fall into the trap of then telling the events of Hannibal's crossing of the Alps. I'm sure that's not the question. Don't tell the events of whatever the question's about. It's for sure, it's asking you to develop an argument. So where can you start when you have that moment of panic? Go back to what you know and what you feel comfortable with. What are the things that your teacher's been saying over and over again? What are those themes that you've heard throughout the study of that particular society? Go back to that and see how many of those central themes apply to this question.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Thank you. So you will have heard your teacher raise a certain, you know, it's usually only four or five themes consistently in the lessons. Go back over those themes and isolate which ones are being raised in this question, and then work out from there. What's the context of the question? So are there dates that give you parameters? Who are the individuals that we know are involved? Who are the groups that are likely to be affected? Then, of the primary sources that you're familiar with. Who speaks about this topic? Because we're always going back to the same primary sources. Who are the historians that you've read who are talking about this topic? And take the time to plan. It's going to be very painful the first few times you force yourself to sit down and plan a topic that you don't feel comfortable with. But every time we practice these things, we get a little bit more confident, and with practice and confidence, we can move more quickly the next time we do it.
I think every student listening to this right now, Isabella, should just pause, rewind, if rewind was still a thing, which it's not, and just take right down what you just said, those step-by-step moments to get through that period of discomfort, which is a reality when you're tackling things like essays and exams. And just remember that you can do this. You do know the knowledge. Just go back to what you've been doing all year and you'll get through it, and take the time to plan. Very key, I think.
Absolutely. Very plan, very important. And it can be quite time consuming at the beginning. And that's okay. I think you should set aside time to plan, particularly when you're starting that process of doing a lot of practice questions. And if necessary, get all your resources out, go back and look. If you really have a sinking feeling and you're not sure, well, go back and find out. There's no point handing your teacher a blank piece of paper. And it's not even very helpful to go back to your teacher and say, "I'm sorry, but I don't understand anything about the Punic Wars." Because they can't engage with that. You have to do a bit of work. You have to figure out what you do know and find where your gaps are.
I think that's really valuable advice. What do you think really sets students up throughout the year for success with their history studies?
I think that having taken good notes, having engaged with the material and learnt all year, the quality of your practice is key.
Oh, what does quality practice look like?
This is a really important distinction. Quantity does not beat quality. So
yes.
I say that and I feel like we should say it a few times because it is.
Do, say it again. Quantity does not beat quality.
It does not. And if you think about other skills that you learn, you know that to be true. Like if you're doing sport or music and you get stuck on something, repeating it again and again in the same way and making the same mistake over and over and over again does not help you to play music better or to be better at goal shooting if you keep making the same mistake. You need an intervention, you need some feedback, and you need to practice differently. It's the same. And this goes to the heart of how we think about learning, which is where I started. And for me, it pretty much colours all of my teaching, and it's where I'm going to finish up. Students sometimes fall into a trap of thinking that you're either just a very good student, an average student or whatever, and that's fixed. And most students have a very clear idea of where they feel they sit in regard to every one of their subjects. And
I can imagine them thinking about that right now.
And they probably can do a rank of their class, and they probably imagine that that is fixed. And I am here to tell you it is not. It is not fixed. What you do changes how you think and how you write, and it will change your final performance. And that's why I started with this idea that deciding that you can be successful, of believing that you have the capacity to be successful, is the single most determining factor. So when it comes to practice, the practice that you do is going to change the quality of the work that you produce. And you can check, you can stop, and you can message your favorite teacher and ask them, have they ever taught a student who has improved significantly as a result of the way that they've practiced?
do it now.
Because I believe that every teacher knows many students.
Oh, absolutely.
For whom that's the case. And if you think of the student that is very good at any subject, but in this case, let's say history, and I want, as students, I want you to recall them to your mind, the one that you feel like they're just so good, they write so well and they understand new material and they're confident in class, I want you to think of them. The reality is there are so many things that they do, tiny little things that they do and have been doing so that they've become habits, and that's what you need to do too. So in terms of practice, what can they do? The best practice for the exam is completing exam-style questions.
Makes sense.
So I always have to highlight possible pitfalls because I know where they are and I know that the students fall into them. One of the biggest pitfalls that I see students falling into before they start completing practice exams is they want their notes to be perfect.
Oh, yep, okay.
They spend hours, weeks perfecting their notes. Now, I'm not saying don't have notes and I'm not saying notes aren't good, but they're not the same as practice. And the reality is you're using that as a bit of procrastination.
Yes, I would. As a self-confessed note-taking procrastinator, I completely agree with that. I wasted so much of my own VCE some years ago doing that. And I just think, oh, I should have just taken the bull by the horns.
Absolutely. Well, think about it. Do you need to rewrite the textbook? Is that necessary?
No.
No.
You can just read it.
You could just read it.
Just highlight the bits that you want to keep rereading. You don't need to. Absolutely.
Make friends with post-it notes and stickies.
Oh, good tip.
You need to identify any of that distorted thinking, which is stopping you from sitting down and doing your own practice. Tell yourself, today I'm going to do a practice question. We're going to build that process up so that you're able to do a whole practice exam before the real exam. But we're not going to throw you right in from the beginning. So when you start, I would suggest that you complete a section of the exam, open book, and without time limits. So 3 days is too long.
When should students ideally, so obviously this podcast will be available for students in 2020 now, or relatively soon, I should say, but for our students who might be listening in, say, next year, when should they start looking at these practice exams?
Practice exam questions could be done throughout the year for the relevant area of study that you've completed. So if you've completed an area of study, then you could look at that relevant section and start then. So you might find that you're starting in June or July for the topics you've studied. No point going further ahead.
No.
By the time we get to September, which is the time we're in now, this is the time, definitely. Allow yourself to do it open book when you start. Allow yourself to take extra time if you need it. Because we've already identified that that intellectual process of developing an argument can be quite painful. So we need whatever supports we can give ourselves to make sure we do a good job. And if that means we want to look something up that we're not too sure about, we're going to do it. If that means we need to take a bit of time, we're going to do that too. And we're going to make it the best practice that we can, and then we're going to submit it to our teacher. And I'm going to get back to that later. Once you're beginning to feel quite confident with the content, so this doesn't mean that you've memorized absolutely everything, but it means that when you look at a question, you start to get ideas about what you should write. You don't have to refer to your notes in order to have to plan your response. Time to close your books. So now take your notes away and try to answer that section of the exam with no time limit.
I like that, building up your exam muscle.
Absolutely. And then as you get proficient with this and it's and if it's not, if you're not feeling comfortable but it's getting to be closer to the exam, So we're talking more term four.
Mm-hmm.
Then you need to start to model exam conditions. So this means I would suggest half an hour per section of the exam because of four sections, it's 2 hours long. And I want you to create a space for yourself which is going to be similar in some ways to the exam room. So it's a space that's clean and tidy, there's no clutter, there's no noise, and you're going to use a timer this time. You don't need to take anything with you, so there's nothing wrong with going to the kitchen table if that's a quiet space, or somewhere where there's nothing else but your paper, your questions, a timer, and give yourself 30 minutes. And you want to be able to complete that section in 30 minutes.
In that time.
Yes.
That's brilliant. Can I ask a question that might lead into what you were alluding to before about, I suppose, accessing the great resource that is your teacher? When you're getting that feedback on some of your writing and perhaps you're thinking, no, I'm making the same mistake, I need to almost host my own intervention here. Should students feel comfortable to approach their teachers and ask for support with this and extra feedback?
Absolutely. Teachers love to do that. I have some tips though. I would actually suggest having a study mate or a couple of study mates in addition to your teacher. And this is because we learn so well. We're very social beings. We learn so well together. And you'll be able to ask each other questions. You'll be able to plan some of those responses together. So it's particularly in that early stage of preparing for the exam when you are looking at questions and you're thinking, that's not the same as my teacher gave me. I'm having a moment of panic. I'm starting to think I haven't learnt anything at all. Then your study mate can jump in and say, no, I think we have and I've got a few ideas. That is a really great way to study. As you become more confident with the material and you're completing your practice questions, I would suggest giving your response to your study mate. You might have more than one.
Okay.
And asking for feedback. Now, that person doesn't have to get the same grade as you on all the SACs to be your study mate, because when you teach something, you become really proficient in it. So don't be afraid of being a study mate with somebody who's not getting the same grades as you. Also, don't be afraid of being a study mate of somebody who you think is getting a higher grade than you are, because it may be that you just need to learn how to structure your responses on paper.
Mm, and this could be an opportunity for you to further expose yourself to that.
Exactly. So this is enormously valuable way of giving feedback. And you can develop with your teacher, or I can give some pointers. You can get it on HTV. Some things to look for. So we're looking for whether or not they've answered the question. We're looking for whether or not they've developed an argument and it makes sense. Are they using evidence to support their argument? Is their writing fluid? Have they missed anything out that's really glaring? If you go through that process, I promise you, it will really build your confidence about the content and answering the questions. It's a fun way to learn. But also, in terms of your feedback, it's going to provide you with an initial layer of feedback on your work. So that when you give this same response to your teacher and you might have corrected the areas that your peer has identified, or you might just give it to your teacher with some comments on it, the feedback that your teacher gives you is going to improve, because they're going to be addressing more sophisticated areas of improvement in your writing. So if you've made a glaring admission or something is missing, your friend has helped you with that. Now the teacher is going to help you to smooth out the integration of your quotes, is going to point out that maybe there's an inconsistency in your argument, or that there's some detailed facts that could be included to support your argument. If you look at
So you're really making the most of your time with the teacher.
Yes. Yes, and I would suggest, in order to do good practice and get good feedback, Don't go to your teacher with 5 or 10 practices, because that goes back to the point we were making earlier about making the same mistakes multiple times. Complete one practice, make it the best practice you can, get some feedback on it, and then present it to your teacher. Make a time to discuss the feedback with your teacher. Now, this won't always be possible for every practice that you do, especially if your teacher's got a very large class. But if you do this a few times, you will have an opportunity to ask questions of the teacher about the skills that you need to develop, so you really understand what it is that you need to work on next. If you get a whole lot of annotation on your work from the teacher, and maybe it's been very well marked, but you're not clear what it is that you need to work on, you need to ask some good questions from your teacher. So you need to ask, what is the main skill that I need to work on now? Have I developed a clear argument? Is there anything in the content that I've missed out? So just ask 1 or 2 questions of your teacher. Again, don't come back and just say, I don't understand. Ask them a question.
Be specific.
Exactly. and then have a look at the feedback. Make sure you're clear about what it is you're working on. And in your next practice, your goal is to address that feedback and to improve upon it. But when you go back, yes, you can do that same question again and improve it if you like. Once you've produced a good answer for that particular practice topic, I want you to move on to another topic. Don't keep completing.
Don't try and perfect a response to one question, because you don't know what question you're going to get. See if you can apply your feedback and your new learning to a new scenario.
Yeah, exactly. Keep looking at different topic areas, and then go through that same process where you've made it a really good practice, you've got a little bit of feedback on it. That whole process should be a bit quicker, because you would have thought about the feedback you've got, and give it to your teacher again.
I suppose the other benefit to providing feedback to your peers is that you can start to see what works and what doesn't, and that may even make you a better assessor of your own work.
Absolutely, yeah. And even that process of seeing what doesn't work helps you, as you say, to find the holes in your own work so that you improve it before you submit it for feedback.
So, Isabella, we've talked about writing and improving your skills and even taking in content to try and, I suppose, broaden your historical horizons. We often talk about VCEs being this great big marathon. What can students do? What approaches can they take to their studies to use this time as best as they can?
I think it's really important, as we said earlier, to be purposeful about what it is you're studying. And in order to really make the most of your learning and to perform at a high level, we need to focus on those activities which are going to add value. And these add value activities, they don't have a due date from the teacher, and so they don't have urgency. So when I'm talking about things that add value, I'm thinking of activities that go a little bit beyond, for example, the set textbook or the resources that the teacher has gone through in their fixed class time. So I would imagine that most teachers, for example, give some additional reading, which is designed to give depth. They might have references to primary sources, or they might have asked students to look for some primary sources, or they might have given some additional practice tasks. So these are the add value extra tasks, as I think of them. They're not due now. The teacher may or may not be collecting them tomorrow. But what they do is they give us a depth of understanding. They provide additional evidence, and they help us sometimes essentially to join the dots. And so they're really very enriching. What we usually do as people is we do the thing that is most urgent first, And then we leave those extra. So my teacher said, I've got these five, how many questions I need, knowledge questions I need to answer for tomorrow. I'll do those first. Then I will have spent half an hour or 45 minutes on my history work. He also gave me this interesting article, but I'm running out of time because I need to move on to another subject. So I'll do that another day. So I want to send a challenge. Try to do your extra add value tasks first.
Oh, that's an interesting approach.
And give yourself, it may be that you don't spend, you know, all of your study time on it. It might be that you say, I'm going to spend a certain amount of time doing extra add value. And depending on how good you are at studying and how disciplined you are to do a certain amount, fix that amount of time. So you might say, I'm going to do 15 minutes of extra add value each time I study. Do it at the beginning. Read that article, think about the ideas, take the additional notes, and then move on. If you don't feel like you're getting enough of those resources, go to your librarian.
And a very often untapped resource.
Amazing resources. If you don't know your librarian, it's time to go and introduce yourself and tell them the subjects you're studying in VCE. Tell them the topics you give them parameters so they know what they're looking for, and then be really clear whether you're looking for historians, primary sources. They're amazing.
I love the idea of add value time, and especially prioritizing it and putting it first rather than doing the due activities first, making sure you're getting that enrichment and that you're furthering your understanding of the content, really.
And you're differentiating yourself from other students.
For sure. So another important thing that I think we need to talk about with VCE students is managing your emotions. It's a tough couple of years, especially year 12. Can be pretty hard to manage, you know, everything that's being thrown at you and trying to juggle that perhaps with a part-time job. You know, what advice would you give to students who are perhaps struggling with that emotional roller coaster?
I think the first thing that I would say to them is that it's really central for every student, regardless of their other considerations, that they take time and that they prioritize their emotional well-being and the level of stress that they're under.
Absolutely.
So it is a priority. And this is something that as a student, you need to make this your priority. If your emotions become too negative, if your thinking becomes too negative, or if you're in a high level of stress, you can't learn and you cannot perform well. So it's something that throughout your whole journey is important. And you know, that's why the goal setting and setting yourself a timetable and setting clear objectives for your study time is all really important. But particularly as you lead up to the exam, almost every student who I have ever taught has experienced some stress, some feelings of being overwhelmed, perhaps feeling anxious during that time period. And there are some things that you can do. The first thing I'd say is to have a circuit breaker. If that's how you feel, you need to stop and you need to take the time to take care of you and get yourself back into a good place.
Yeah, there's no point pushing through because you will not do anything efficiently if you're feeling that way.
No. Nothing that you produce in that state is highly valuable. So stop and do what is good for you to help you to recover. Now, we know that exercise is really helpful. We know that breathing techniques are incredibly helpful. We know that reaching out and telling somebody how you feel really helps you. Making a plan is very helpful.
So like a study plan?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And even before you get into that, I think it's important to have some stress management techniques that work for you. So I said exercise, breathing, time out. It's really important through year 12 to have some time out. Not the whole year. you do have to do work, but at times, you need to have time where you've given yourself permission. I'm not studying now. I'm having time with family and friends, and I'm going to relax and enjoy myself.
Because that's okay.
And it absolutely is okay. The other thing to be aware of is that our thoughts and our emotions can be a bit cyclical. They can create a kind of cycliness that can escalate up to a state where we're feeling really stressed, or downwards where we start to feel calmer and in control. So think about this. We might have a trigger. For example, we have an assessment that's due, and then that can start to generate thoughts. Sometimes, even though our mind is wonderful, our thoughts can be a little bit disordered, and they can be unhelpful to us and unhelpful to finding a way through. So we can start to feel like we start to say things to ourselves like, I'm going to fail, and then I'll fail VCE. I haven't done any study, so it'll be a disaster. I hear students say to me, I'm not going to do as well as my parents want, and they're going to kill me. I'm here to tell you, they're not. Every parent wants their child to progress well, calmly and smoothly through this difficult year. And they want you to be okay, and they want you to be happy. Yes, I'm sure they also want you to work. But if you can catch some of those thoughts and stop them from spiraling. So there can be a process where we have this thought, it spirals around our mind, it creates an emotion in us, and then that impacts our action.
So I suppose acknowledging the thought, but then perhaps correcting it or asserting yourself against it and saying, no, I have done my best, I have put in the time, and sort of taking your authority back. Could I ask just quickly, I've seen sometimes outside exams, the students walk out and you hear one student go, oh, well, I failed that. Would you encourage students to try and distance themselves from those kinds of conversations?
Yes. Yes. But I would encourage you to have a support team.
Yes.
And think about what a support team does. You know, this is like your pit crew. These are the yes. people who are going to refuel you and repair you and correct them, you know, these disordered thoughts when you might have them. So do have people you can reach out to. But if there are people who are saying things which are unhelpful, it's best to avoid those conversations. You need to stop some of that thinking and reground yourself and correct yourself and come back to the why you are doing this. You know, it's not for anybody. It's not about perfection. It's about learning. It's about enjoying your year. It's about learning with your peers. It's about the skills you develop. It's about performing well based on the work that you've done. And I'm confident that, you know, students have done the work and they will perform well. And remember, we decided we were going to choose to believe that we could do it.
Absolutely.
This is where we need to remember that decision, that we are going to choose to believe that we can do it and we're going to behave accordingly.
Yes. Yes. Regulate. Be the regulator of your own behaviour. Be your own. I don't want to say be your own parent. I don't think that's quite right. But you're sort of taking a nurturing role towards yourself.
Yes, you're moving towards adulthood.
That's a big part of it.
So do find relaxation methods or stress management methods, whatever term you prefer, that work for you. And you should be practicing this throughout the year, because throughout the year of Year 12, there are going to be assessment peaks. Times where the sacs seem to be clustered. So it's important to be practicing these methods throughout the year. The more you practice it, the more habitual it will become. People say the brain's a muscle. It's not a muscle, but habits are created with practice.
Absolutely. And if you're listening to this and you're thinking, I don't have time for stress management, you are the person who needs the stress management.
That's right. It's not, and that's one of the things that I've been trying to say. Yes, we are talking about a significant time investment. We are talking about doing work, but there's not a direct correlation between acres and acres of time spent rewriting information or practicing the same thing over. It's about how you use your time, and it's about what you do with your time. And on time, I think it is important to in the study period from September through to the exam period to have a study timetable.
Yep.
It's a bit like having a goal. It gives you a focus and it gives you structure. And the first thing that you need to do after you've made your study timetable is remember that it won't always go to plan, and that's okay. I suggest, first thing I say to my students is, it's not even a suggestion, I retract that. So get up, get dressed, do not study in your bed, have your breakfast, take care of yourself. We're eating food here, people. And you can have a study timetable however you choose. However, I don't think it's particularly helpful, or it's never been helpful to me, to divide my time into, say, I'm going to do half an hour of history, half an hour of maths, half an hour of science. That would never work for me. I couldn't work. So I would suggest something like from breakfast time, you've got a morning session, you might break that into two and focus on a subject area. Then after lunch, to the afternoon tea time, another session. And then again from afternoon tea towards dinner time, another session.
Your brain needs breaks.
It does. It have, and that's the other thing. Have breaks, have food, go outside, exercise. And I wouldn't advise students to be studying late into the evening. You need to have some downtime. You need to allow your mind to switch off. You need to reconnect with your family and friends and have a little break from your study. And don't think of this as useful time. Think of this useless time, sorry. Think of this as time where you're resetting. You're allowing your brain and your body and all of those emotions to recalibrate and relax. We're making sure we have social time, that we laugh and have fun, and we have rest, so that when you come to sleep, your brain is not whirring at the speed of trying to nut out complicated problems, that you've actually given it a bit of a rest. And whilst all of that is happening, the information, the concepts is turning around in there and you're making connections. So I know in terms of metacognition that it's useful. I also want you to have good sleep. So I want you to be asleep before 12.
Yes, please. Yes, definitely. Makes you all the more, I suppose, ready to tackle the next day. As tempting as it is, as tempting as it can be to burn the candle at both ends of the spectrum and stay up late at night, you pay the price for it the next day.
And the reality is the work that you do is not of a high quality. You might not be able to see that until the next day, but it's not the same quality that you will produce, you know, during sort of normal people operating hours.
Absolutely. I feel like our motto today is quality over quantity, and I think that's not a bad one to have when you're navigating your VCE studies.
I think so too. You want to come to the end of this whole process and feel like you're proud of what you've done and you've done a good job, but you've also enjoyed the experience.
Absolutely. Isabella, when you look back over the years, is there anything that you can pinpoint that your highest achieving students had in common?
Intellectual curiosity.
Oh, I like that.
Interest in the subject, not just the study design. They asked good questions, penetrating questions and difficult questions. I am looking at my desk and it's got post-it notes of questions my students have asked me, and I don't always know the answer. I often have to research to really delve into that. They do apply themselves.
Yep, that's the bottom line, isn't it?
They seek feedback and they take it on board, they listen to it, and they try to respond to it.
That's great advice.
Thank you.
Any final advice for our listeners today?
To keep remembering why you chose history and remember that you can do it, and be clear about your goal, but also then be quite purposeful about your tasks.
That sounds great. Thank you so much, Isabella, for your time today. I've really enjoyed speaking to you. I'm sure our listeners will have gotten heaps out of this interview. We do hope that you, our listeners, have enjoyed listening. And for more information, please do check out our show notes. There'll be a bit more there. Be sure to tune into the rest of the series as we learn more about how to make the most of your potential. This podcast is supported by the Victorian Department of Education, and they would love to hear what you think, as would we. Please do take the time to complete the evaluation form to assist us in developing further resources for VCE history students.